Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now starting on the book of 2 Samuel. I will not give an introduction to the book because it's basically a continuation of 1 Samuel. We start now with 2 Samuel chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. Before I do that, let me tell you the context. Remember, in the original Jewish canon, 1 and 2 Samuel weren't even divided. They were part of the same book, and it's very obvious here as you read it because the story picks up right where 1 Samuel left off. Saul had just been killed, along with his son Jonathan, at the Battle of Gilboa as the Philistines wiped him out. And so we start now at 2 Samuel 1, verses 1 through 3. Now, it came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, that David remained 2 days in Ziklag. On the third day, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul, with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And it came about, when he came to David, that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. Then David said to him, "From where do you come?" And he said, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." Now, Saul's died. David returns from the slaughter of the Amalekites. Now, if you recall, David was hiding out with the Philistines in Gath, the king of which was Achish. David had Achish's complete trust, but the other Philistine commanders did not trust David, and so they told Achish to send David home, which Achish did. David was living at Ziklag in the southwest of Israel in the Philistine plain. That city apparently was under the control of Achish, and so David had that city down there to himself, he and his 600 men. Now, when David returned from the Philistine army up near Jezreel, Gilboa, where the battle took place, the battle between the Philistines and Saul took place, David returns. He goes home to Ziklag and finds out that Ziklag was burnt to the ground because the Amalekites had taken advantage of its defenseless position and had wiped it out, the city, taking the women and the children and the oxen and the sheep and so forth. Well, David chased the Amalekites down, went down to the brook Besor, if you recall, down in the south, and he whooped them. Gets all of his booty back, plus some more that the Amalekites had gotten on their raids down there in the south. And so David has come back to Ziklag, and of course the city is burnt, but it's apparently not utterly consumed. David may have lived in tents while the rebuilding was done. So while David is down at Ziklag trying to get his city back together, on the third day a man comes from Saul's camp up from Mount Gilboa with his clothes torn on his head. The text says in verse 2, on the third day, that could be the third day after the battle at Gilboa was fought and Saul was killed and Jonathan was killed, or it could be the third day after David slew the Amalekites who would burn his city down. We don't know. At any rate, a man comes out of the camp from the camp of Saul with his clothes torn and dust on his head, the traditional sign of mourning. He prostrated himself before David. Why did he do that? Because he knew that David was about to be king, not Saul's surviving son, Ishbosheth. Remember, Saul had 3 sons killed at Gilboa. The 4th son, Ishbosheth, had been left back at the capital at Gibeah. And this man figured, nah, Benjamin's wiped out. Saul's family is wiped out. Is David going to be the king? Everybody knew that. And so David looks at this man with the ashes on his head and his clothes torn and says, "From where do you come?" Now, David probably knew where he came from, looking at the man's appearance and the circumstances. David knew there was about to be a big battle fought up there at Jezreel in the Jezreel Valley with Saul and the Philistines. So he's just looking for confirmation. And then when the man told him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel," escaped, oh, that probably told David to expect bad news concerning Israel if you have to escape, i.e. escape from the Philistines. So now we go to 1 Samuel chapter 1, verses 4 through 10. David said to him, no doubt with foreboding, David said to this Amalekite, "How did things go? Please tell me." And he, the Amalekite, said, "The people have fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and Jonathan and his son are dead also." Bad news. So David said to the young man who told him, to the Amalekite, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" He apparently doesn't want to believe this bad news. Verse 6, the young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and behold, Saul was leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen pursued him closely." So the Amalekite cooks up a tall tale here, as we'll see. The Amalekite continues talking to David, "When he, Saul, looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and I said, 'Here I am.' He, Saul, said to me, Who are you? And I answered him, I am an Amalekite. Then he, Saul, said to me, Please stand beside me and kill me, for agony has seized me because my life still lingers in me. So the Amalekite continues talking to David in verse 10, So I stood beside him, beside Saul, and killed him, because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm, and I brought them here to my lord. Now the Amalekite says, By chance he was on Mount Gilboa. As why? As a soldier fighting for the Philistines? Or just a traveler, just sightseeing, wanting to see the war? That seems kind of fishy to me. But anyway, he says, David, by chance I just happened to be up there. And look, I saw Saul leaning on his spear. Now what does that mean, leaning on his spear? Well, it means that he had tried to kill himself by leaning on his spear. He's still standing up. And behold, the chariots and the horsemen pursued him closely. Now, this is not true. No chariots and horsemen were pursuing Saul. He was killed by arrows. 1 Samuel 31:3, when the battle intensified against Saul, the archers caught up with him and severely wounded him. I assume that's from a distance, a moderate distance. Now, according to the Amalekite story, Saul told the Amalekite, Agony has seized me. Well, that might be true. Physical pain, fear of the Philistines torturing him, that's probably true to life. Has seized me because my life still lingers in me. Well, that was a lie. He was still living okay when he killed himself. 1 Samuel 31:4-5. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, Draw your sword and pierce me through with it. Otherwise, these uncircumcised will come and pierce me through and make sport of me. So that's probably a tall tale, although it ostensibly could be true, because Saul was wounded. He could have been wounded badly, about to die. So we'll give the Amalekite this benefit of the doubt here. So I stood beside him and killed him. Now, that's not true, because the armor bearer killed him. Well, actually, the armor bearer didn't kill him. Armor bearer chickened out. Saul fell on the sword and killed himself. So this was a cooked up story. Why did the Amalekite make it up? He probably thought David would be happy to hear this story, because after all, Saul's been chasing David for years. David and Saul are enemies. He probably thought David would give him a reward, as the NIV Study Bible suggests. I don't doubt it. That was his motive. Now, one part of the story that's a little bit fishy. The Amalekite says that Saul could not live after he had fallen, but actually he hadn't really fallen. He was leaning on his spear. That shows he still had enough life in him to stand up, so that sounds a little bit fishy. Saul's not lying on the ground about to die when the Amalekite comes up. Because he's standing, that would mean that Saul had tried to kill himself and failed, and that might mean there's still some hope that Saul would live. Well, you could say that, or you could also say, well, he was leaning, and then by the time we get to verse 10, he fell down on the ground, and the Amalekite says, I don't think he can live. At any rate, how much of the story is true, how much of the story is false, really doesn't matter. What matters is that he did not kill Saul, though he claimed to. We know that's not true. Saul killed himself. And then the Amalekite tells David, Look, I've taken the crown on his head and the bracelets on his arm, and I've brought them to you, my lord David. Well, perhaps the Amalekite took the jewelry off of Saul when he saw Saul dead there. He got there before anybody else did. That's probably reasonable. If he took the crown off of Saul's head, if that little detail was true, then that would have made Saul a conspicuous target for the Philistines. But some say, no, he wouldn't have done that. He carried the crown into battle so it would be ready for Saul to put it on after Saul won the battle, which he didn't. But at any rate, it's ironic that Saul's crown is taken off his head by an Amalekite. Remember, Saul had refused to kill the Amalekites, and that was the reason Saul said, God's taking your kingdom away, Saul. That was the second time at Gilgal when Samuel confronted Saul. And anyway, the crown is an obvious symbol of the kingdom, the king of Israel, and also a bracelet. Now, Adam Clark says this, quote, It is sometimes customary in the East for a sovereign prince to give a crown and bracelets when investing others with dominion or authority over certain provinces. Jameson Fawcett and Brown say, quote, The bracelet was, quote, the armlet worn above the elbow, an ancient mark of royal dignity. It is still worn by kings in some eastern countries, so it's not really a bracelet. It's more like an armlet. We go now to 2 Samuel chapter 1, verses 11 through 12. Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so also did all the men who were with him. They mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the people of the Lord of the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. Now, when David and company were mourning and weeping, this was sincere. This was not a ritualistic mourning, as so often done back in those times. They were very, very sad. It's ironic. They were mourning the very king that had been trying so hard to kill them. No schadenfreude there. Now, here's some facts that might explain the mourning. David had been reconciled to Saul. David had refused to kill Saul twice at Engedi and Hakalah. Let me read the scripture at Hakalah the second time, 1 Samuel 26:21. Saul responded, "I have sinned. Come back, my son David. I will never harm you again, because today you considered my life precious. I have been a fool. I've committed a grave error." And so you could say, see there, they're reconciled. And then after that, Saul made no further attempts to capture David, so David might have felt like he was reconciled to Saul. Well, that was one reason why David was mourning, David and company. But also, David was mourning because Saul was something more than a personal relation to David. He was the king of Israel, and Israel had just suffered a major defeat. And the Philistines were no doubt rejoicing over this, and the Philistines were Israel's enemies. Notice that it was not just for Saul that David and company were mourning. In verse 12, it says, "For the people of the Lord and the house of Israel." So it's not just Saul they're mourning for. And also not just Saul they were mourning for, Jonathan they were mourning for. Jonathan was David's close friend. He was dead. Also, the death of Saul meant difficult and dark days ahead of Israel. In the last audio, I pointed out that almost all the area there north of the Jezreel Valley had gone over to the Philistines without a fight. The Israelites just abandoned the cities. The same thing happened in the Transjordan area east of the Jordan River. People just abandoned the cities. The Israelites did, and the Philistines just marched in with no more battle. That's the kind of kingdom David's going to have to take over. So even if Saul was corrupt, his death meant bad news for Israel. And of course, David's mourning because Israel had just suffered a humiliating defeat by their perpetual enemy, the Philistines. It's so often we read these Old Testament stories, the chronicles of warfare and such, and the people seem like tin figures. They seem like kind of like robots going through the motions. But no, when that people got killed in war, it was a sad thing. They cried just like we would cry. We go now to 2 Samuel 1, verses 13 through 16. David said to the young man who told him, "Where are you from?" And he answered, this is the Amalekite, "Where are you from, Amalekite?" David says. And he answered, "I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite." Then David said to him, "How is it you were not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" i.e. Saul. And David called one of the young men and said, "Go, cut him down." So he, the young man, struck the Amalekite, and the Amalekite died. David said to him, said to the Amalekite, "Your blood is on your head, for your mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointing.'" Now, you could say David said to the corpse lying on the ground. He could have done that. Or it could be the verses are out of time order. That happens a lot. In verse 13, David asked the Amalekite, "Where are you from?" Now, the question arises here. Why did David ask the Amalekite this again, since he had already asked him in verse 8? Actually, David hadn't asked him in verse 8. The Amalekite is recounting that Saul had asked the Amalekite in this cooked up version of events. Saul says, "Who are you?" And then the young man answered, "I'm an Amalekite." So David heard that. So why did he ask again? Well, maybe he didn't really want to know where he was from, but who his master was, because the man answered, "I'm the son of an alien, an Amalekite." So he's not interested in the geographical location of his origin. He just wanted to know, was the man a slave, and who his master was? Or it could be that David's state of mind was so upset that he had forgotten what the Amalekite had said. Or it could just be that David wanted it repeated for the sake of confirmation. Where are you from? Now, of course, the Amalekites are Israel's lifelong enemies, as I've said over and over again in previous audios. So this man was taking a chance, and unfortunately it didn't pay off for him. Because David, in verse 14, says, "How is it you were not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" In other words, how could you have done that? David was shocked that the man would do something so horrible. And then he says to one of his soldiers, "Go cut this man down." Now, the question might arise, why was the Amalekite not given a chance to defend himself? As John Gill says, quote, "Kings and generals of armies had great power in those times and countries to execute a man immediately without any other judge or jury." Folks, that's the way it is in war. I remember Stonewall Jackson. There were two shirkers or deserters or laggards. I forgot what they had done in some particular battle years ago. I read this. And he said, "Go out there and string them up as an example to the rest of the troops." I said, "Oh, Stonewall, that's kind of rough." War is rough, war is hell, as William Tecumseh Sherman said as he marched through Georgia, burning down the farms of the native Georgians. War is hell. At any rate, the man had condemned himself with the words of his own mouth. He said, "I killed the king." It was what fact-finding exercises needed to be done, what judicial exercises needed to be done. He had killed the king of Israel, while he's wounded, no less. David may have heard the story and thought that the Amalekite was taking revenge on Saul, because remember, the Amalekites were the enemies of Israel and the enemies of Saul. Saul had given the Amalekites a good bit of trouble in 1 Samuel 15:7. Then Saul struck down the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is next to Egypt. That's in the south, where the Amalekites were wandering around as nomads. And so David might have looked at that and said, "You know, you young man of Amalek, you know you hated Saul. You were taking revenge on him, and now you're going to die for it." Another reason that David might have said to cut down the young Amalekite was to show respect to Saul, as John Gill and Jameson Foster and Brown suggest. Killing the Amalekite would ingratiate David into the favor of Saul's friends. As we're going to see as we go through 2 Samuel, David had political problems in taking over the kingdom from Saul because the Benjamites, the followers of Saul, still had power. And David was an outlaw with 600 men. Well, when David cut down the Amalekite who had dishonored Saul, that made David look good in the eyes of the old regime. That would help him ascend the throne. Another reason David might have cut down this young Amalekite was to deter people from thinking it's okay to assassinate kings. After all, David was about to become a king. He didn't want people to think regicide was an option without consequences. Gill and Jameson Foster and Brown suggest that motive. The fifth reason why David might have cut down that Amalekite, because God, through Samuel, had chosen Saul. Saul was God's anointed, as David continually called him. And David wanted to show that no one had the right to kill God's anointed. God anointed him. He might have been a jerk, but God anointed him. In other words, David is respecting the office, if not the person, even though Saul had brought nothing but disgrace upon the monarchy. Now, this Amalekite had killed Saul, but David went in two similar situations, when Saul was in distress. He didn't kill Saul, but this Amalekite did. At En-Gedi, the first time, we read in 1 Samuel 24:6, "So he," that's David, "said to his men, 'Far be it from me, because of the Lord, that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch up my hand against him, since he is the Lord's anointed.'" That was at En-Gedi, on the coast of the Dead Sea, the western coast. When Saul was relieving himself in the same cave that David was hiding out with his men, and David had a chance to slice off a piece of Saul's garment and show it to him later and say, "I could have got you, Saul, but I didn't." And then also at Hakalah, which is maybe 6, 7, 8 miles to the west of En-Gedi in the hill country there, the wilderness, David also spared Saul's life, 1 Samuel 26:11. "However, because of the Lord, I will never lift my hand against the Lord's anointed. Instead, take the spear and the water jug by his head and let's go." That was at Hakalah, when David and Abishai sneaked through the 3,000 soldiers that were camped around Saul, and then through Saul's inner bodyguard there, and Saul was sleeping, and they took the spear and the water jug, showed it to him later, and said, "I could have got you again, Saul, but I didn't." So David was respecting the Lord's anointed, and this guy had done exactly the opposite, and David was ticked off. So we go now to 2 Samuel chapter 1, verses 17 through 18. "Then David chanted with this lament over Saul and Jonathan his son, and he told them to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. 'Behold, it is written,'" the song of the bow is written in the book of Jasher. Now, the song of the bow, why is it called the song of the bow? Well, there's a couple of options. The first option is the route the KJV takes. That version translates the verse, "Also he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow." Now, if that's true, then this is a parenthetical remark to show that amidst the lamentation, he hadn't forgotten the defense of Judah, as John Gill suggests. No, I find that hard to believe. Why would you put a parenthesis in right there? The idea doesn't fit in with the context at all. However, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown disagree with me on that. They say, quote, "The natural sense of this parenthetical verse is that David took immediate measures for instructing the people in the knowledge and practice of archery, their great inferiority to the enemy in this military arm having been the main cause of the late national disaster." Well, that's a nice speculation, but the word use is not in the Hebrew, as Adam Clark says. The use of the bow is not in the Hebrew. The NIV translates it as the lament of the bow. Then ESB has the song of the bow. And I think that's the option we are going to go with. The song of the Holman Christian Study Bible also has song of the bow. Now, the NIV translation points out that the purpose of the song is a lamentation. Adam Clark says, quote, "This lamentation is justly admired as a picture of distress, the most tender and the most striking, unequally divided by grief into longer and shorter breaks, as nature could pour them forth from a mind interrupted by the alternate recurrence of the most lively images of love and greatness." His reverence for Saul, David's reverence for Saul, and his love for Jonathan have their strongest colorings, but their greatness and bravery come full upon him and are expressed with peculiar energy. Being himself a warrior, David being a warrior, it is in that character he sees their greatest excellence. And though his imagination hurries from one point of recollection to another, yet we hear him, at first, at last, everywhere, lamenting, "How are the mighty fallen?" It is almost impossible to read the noble original without finding every word swollen with a sigh or broken with a sob. A heart pregnant with distress and striving to utter expressions descriptive of its feelings, which are repeatedly interrupted by an excess of grief, is most sensibly painted throughout the whole. That 19th century rhetoric is amazing to me. Clark's description of the poem is almost better than the poetry itself. Okay, so it's a song of the bow. It's talking about war. Now, the song of the bow may refer particularly to Jonathan's bow, as Adam Clark says, especially respecting the bow of Jonathan, which returned not back from the blood of the slain, as the song itself expresses. And David could not but remember the bow of Jonathan, out of which the arrow was shot beyond the lad. It was the time when that covenant was made and that affection expressed between them, which was greater than the love of women. Well, that's a stretch to me to think that David is thinking about that bow when they cooked up that scheme so that Jonathan could tell David that Saul is indeed mad at you. You better flee. And so Jonathan said, "If I shoot the arrow when I'm practicing my archery, the arrow goes beyond the servant who's retrieving the arrows." And I say, "The arrow's beyond you. Keep going." And David's supposed to hide behind in a rock and hears that and he takes off to leave Gibeah. I think that's a stretch. I think it's just talking about the bow of Jonathan because Jonathan used the bow as a warrior. Cambridge commentator says the bow must be a title given to David's elegy from the mention of Jonathan's bow in 2 Samuel 1:22, which we're going to get to in just a minute. All right, so this is the song of the bow, which is recorded in the book of Jasher. John Gill says of this book seems to have been a public register or annals in which were recorded memorable actions in any age, and had its name from the uprightness and faithfulness in which it was kept. The word Jasher means upright, the book of the upright. Easton's Illustrated Dictionary says that the book of Jasher is rendered in the Septuagint the book of the upright one. The Vulgate translates it as the book of the just ones. It was probably a kind of national sacred song book, a collection of songs in praise of the heroes of Israel, a book of golden deeds, a national anthology. We have only two specimens from the book. One, the words of Joshua, which he spoke to the Lord at the crisis of the Battle of Beth-horon. That's when, right south of Beth-horon in the Valley of Ajalon, the moon and the sun stood still. You recall that story? So the book of Jasher records that story. And then two, the Song of the Bow, which is where we are here. Ellicott says, this book, the book of Jasher, is also referred to in Joshua 10:13. That's the Battle of Beth-horon. And nothing more is really known about it, although it has been the subject of endless discussion and speculation. Well, we're not going to speculate anymore. We will instead go to 2 Samuel 1, verses 19 through 22. David's poetry continues. His song of the bow continues. Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How have the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, or the daughters of the Philistines will rejoice. The daughters of the uncircumcised will exult. O mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back. Fat means the strength. And the word of Saul did not return empty. I misspoke there. Fat doesn't really speak to the strength of Jonathan's enemies. Holman Christian Study Bible translates it as the bodies of Saul's enemies. In other words, the sword of Saul did not return empty from slicing up the bodies of the enemies. Now, this is a song. It reminds me of people at funerals. You know, the guy was an SOB while he was living, but when he's dead, he's the greatest thing that never ate peanut butter. I mean, just was a wonderful person. Saul didn't feast. His sword did not feast on the bodies of the mighty Philistines. They feasted on his body. So we got to give David a little bit of poetic license here. Verse 19, how have the mighty fallen? That's the chorus of the Song of the Bow. It's repeated three times, twice more after this. The mighty would include all the valiant Israelite soldiers, as John Gill says, not just Saul and Jonathan. It's interesting, that phrase has made itself into the English language. I've used it myself plenty of times, not even realizing where it came from. So David in verse 20 says, tell it not in Gath. Gath is, of course, one of the five chief cities of the Philistines. That's where Goliath was from, that David had killed, the giant. That's where David had taken refuge under Achish, the king of Gath. And he's imagining them jumping up and down for joy. We just whipped up the wound the Israelites. David says, no, I don't want to hear that. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Ashkelon, of course, is the city where the famous Temple of Astarte is, one of the five famous cities of the Philistines. It's near the Mediterranean coast. Gaza being to the south and Ashdod to the north of Ashkelon. Those two cities were also Philistine cities. So Ashkelon is famous for being a Philistine city. And he's saying, don't you exalt over the fact that you just beat the Israelites. So in other words, David says, don't let anybody know of this Philistine victory in Gath or Ashkelon, or else the daughters of the Philistines will rejoice. The daughters of the uncircumcised will exult, which is exactly what happened, of course. So then David says in verse 21, O mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you. A curse. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says the curse seems still to lie upon them, for the mountains of Gilboa are naked and sterile. So no dew or rain on Gilboa, no dew or rain on the fields of offerings. The Septuagint has first fruits on the fields of first fruits. In other words, the fields that produce the crops that are given as first fruits. No dew or rain on those fields either. The fields that belong to the Philistines. David was good at imprecating the enemies of God. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, there on Mount Gilboa. How was the shield of the mighty defiled? Well, the King James translates it as cast away. The shield of the mighty was cast away. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown said to cast away the shield was counted a national disgrace. Yet on that fatal battle of Gilboa, many of the Jewish soldiers who had displayed unflinching valor in former battles, forgetful of their own reputation and their country's honor, threw away their shields and fled from the field. This dishonorable and cowardly conduct is alluded to with exquisitely touching pathos. That makes sense to me. That's how the shields of the mighty were defiled. There's another option. The Holman Christian Study Bible takes this verse 21 and refers in a footnote to 1 Samuel 31:4, which reads this, Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and run me through with it, or these uncircumcised men will come and run me through and torture me. But the armor bearer would not do it because he was terrified. Then Saul took his sword and fell on it. And so this option says that the poem is referring to Saul's armor bearer defiling Saul's armor because the armor bearer killed Saul. I guess if you kill Saul, you make his armor worthless, especially since your armor bearer did it. I don't know. I think that's a stretch. I think the best answer is the shield of the mighty Israelites was defiled as they were thrown. Well, it's in the singular for the shield of the mighty, meaning taking an individual Israelite soldier, he threw his shield down and he defiled it. The individual is taken as an example of the whole. The shield of Saul was not anointed with oil. John Gill interprets that as meaning that the shield of Saul was anointed with blood instead of oil. There's another way you can look at it or interpret it. Shields were usually anointed with oil in preparation for battle. That was so that enemy weapons would glance off the shield, as the NIV Study Bible points out. Anointing the shield with oil would make the leather last longer in bad weather. And so, when you anoint your shield with oil, that is a symbol for preparing for battle, similar to our expression, roll up your sleeves. And so, when David says here, the shield of Saul was not anointed with oil, in other words, it wasn't prepared properly to defend Saul, and he died. I tend to think that's what David meant, not that the poem is implying that the shield was anointed with blood instead of with oil. Verse 22, from the blood of the slain, from the fat of the bodies of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back. Well, I'm sure Jonathan got his licks in before he got cut down. And the sword of Saul did not return empty. Well, we'll give him that. They managed to take some out with him before they died. So David continues with the song of the bow in 2 Samuel chapter 1, verses 23 through 27, and we'll finish up this chapter. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life, and in their death they were not parted. Saul, beloved and pleasant. Really? Again, this sounds like a funeral oration. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How have the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? The mighty Saul is mighty. Jonathan is slain on your high places. Now, Jonathan was a good guy. I suspect that David is really mourning Jonathan more than he's mourning Saul. Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. How have the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? So, beloved Saul and Jonathan, in verse 23, in their death they were not parted. They died together. Now, the fact that they died together, this cleared Jonathan from any implication of conspiracy in getting David enthroned. So nobody could say, well, this is just a regime change with a bunch of conspiracy. No, this was God to put David on the throne. Jonathan had nothing to do with it, even though he was Jonathan's good friend. Jonathan's memory would not be tainted with the accusation that he was a traitor to his own father and to his kingdom. David says that Saul and Jonathan in verse 23, that those two were swifter than eagles. Well, maybe so, but they weren't swifter than the Philistines that caught up with them. They were stronger than lions. Well, maybe so, but the Philistines were even stronger than they were. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet. Well, now that's probably true. Saul had made the kingdom prosperous. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, the fondness for dress, which anciently distinguished Oriental women, is their characteristic still. It appeared in their love of bright, gay, and diverse colors, and profuse display of ornaments, and in various other forms. Well, all women like, well, I can't say all, but usually in most cultures, most times, most places, women like to have bright colors when they dress up. That's just the way women are. But they got to have money to do it, and Saul gave the women of Israel money to do it. They could dress luxuriously. Again, he's exaggerating. Ornaments of gold. And finally, David in verse 26 says, I'm distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Well, David was actually Jonathan's brother-in-law, as John Gill points out. He had married Jonathan's sister, Michal. But he was also a brother through love and affection. So he calls him his brother. Hey, bro, Jonathan. Jonathan, your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. Now, what does that mean, the love of women? Well, I take it as the love of a wife or a husband. Could be the love of a mother for her children. I don't think that's what David meant. It could have been the love of David's two wives in particular, not just wives in general, but David's two wives in particular that he had, the love of Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel. Michal has been taken away from it at this point by Saul. And he said, I'd rather have you, Jonathan, than the love of my two wives. Ooh, I hope the two wives didn't hear about this. I guess they did because it was a song. I'm sure they forgave David for his grief. Verse 27, David repeats the sad refrain, how have the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? That could be a reference to the actual weapons that the Israelites lost at near Gilboa. Or it could be that Saul and Jonathan are here poetically described as weapons of war. Weapons against the Philistines, and they have perished. At any rate, the whole sad song is over with, and we are now finished with 2 Samuel 1. We are now ready to launch into chapter 2 of 2 Samuel. In chapter 2, David becomes king, and he fights the Battle of Gibeon. I hope you stay tuned for that story, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.